the debate.
The U.S. President Joe Biden and the Russian President Vladimir Putin have had the first initial contact, and there has been some strides made. First, an agreement on the New START Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, cornerstone of global arms control, was reached. Russia has also reiterated a stance that the U.S. should return to the Iran nuclear deal. Well, in this edition of the debate, we will look at the other issues that these two nuclear powers might share, like NATO and Ukraine.
Russia-U.S. relations have generally been tense, with their ups and downs since the end of the Cold War, dragging them into policies and sometimes even conflict. Now a new administration in the U.S. offers a glimmer of hope, with all eyes now on the direction of the bilateral ties the two countries could pursue. In one of the initial moves to reduce tension, U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin agreed to extend the 2010 New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty for 5 more years. The agreement was failed to materialize under former U.S. President Donald Trump, whose administration insisted on a conditional renewal of the accord, which Moscow rejected. The Obama-era agreement puts a limit on the number of strategic nuclear warheads, missiles, and bombers Russia and the U.S. can deploy. The Russian president hailed Washington's move to extend the New START. However, he warned that the situation could still develop unpredictably.
The extension of the START Treaty is definitely a step in the right direction. But I repeat, the situation can develop unpredictably and uncontrollably if, of course, we do nothing to prevent this from happening.
The treaty, which was due to expire on February 5th, provided a rare opportunity for compromise between Moscow and Washington. However, the first phone call between Biden and Putin showed their bilateral disagreements are too wide to resolve. During the call, Biden raised concerns over what he called aggression against Ukraine and warned about Russia's meddling in 2016 U.S. presidential election. He also addressed the reports of bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan and recent massive cyber hack that has been blamed on Moscow, accusations that Russia has categorically denied. The conversation also included recent protests in Russia in support of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. This is while the Kremlin accuses the U.S. of promoting anti-government protests in Russia and interfering in its domestic affairs. Following the phone call, the White House, in a statement, reiterated the tough U.S. stance on Russia.
President Biden made clear that the United States will act firmly in defense of its national interests in response to actions by Russia that harm us or our allies.
The Kremlin also issued a statement about the conversation between the leaders of the two countries that underscored troubled relations as well.
President Putin noted that the normalization of relations between Russia and the United States would meet the interests of both countries, and, taking into account their special responsibility for maintaining security and stability in the world of the entire international community.
Can one expect a reset in U.S.-Russia relations while the Biden administration has already inherited thorny ties put in place by his predecessor, even with Washington's close allies? The world will be waiting and watching how Washington and Moscow manage their many differences and seek common ground to avoid escalatory confrontation.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate is Richard Black, former Senator, Virginia State Senate, who joins us from Ashburn. We'd also like to welcome Daniel Kobalik, who's an author, lecturer, and lawyer, joining us from Pittsburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. Richard Black, let me first start with you. So you have this phone call, and you have this initial contact between Putin and Biden. And, well, they had failed to agree an extension under former U.S. President Donald Trump. And I'm referring to the New START Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. What did happen? What happened under Biden to have this come back that Trump rejected? What were the reasons?
Well, I think, first of all, the extension of the nuclear treaty was obviously a very positive thing. The Russians didn't ask for any preconditions. They just said, let's continue it and let's talk. I think it was a very wise decision for the Biden administration to say, yes, we will look and we will work towards extending it. One of the problems, I supported some things Trump did, I opposed others. I was not a fan of Mike Pompeo. I saw him as less of a diplomat and more of a bully. And his objective was to simply dismantle all of the nuclear treaties that were worked on for decades and decades by generations of good-hearted Americans and good-hearted Russians. So the fact that we're able to hang on to that one treaty, I think, is a very positive thing. Now, in the same conversation, you know, Biden, he is subject to pressures from the deep state, from all of the corporate interests in war. And so he, you know, he talked about the Navalny poisonings or alleged poisonings, and he raised those issues. He raised some other issues, which will keep the deep state satisfied that he's not going to be too friendly. But I think at least there's reason for some hope and some optimism. There certainly is good reason to see improvement in our relations with Iran. And I think to some extent, you know, the Obama administration continues to live on in some fashion. And they saw the JCPOA as being a very major development for them. And right. I think there's at least a hint that may still be in the works.
Okay, well, we're going to, you touched on a number of issues there. We're going to break those down one by one if time allows us. So, Daniel Kovalik, let me come to you regarding NATO first, in no order of importance here. Biden sought to repair this strained relation that was between the U.S. and Europe by stressing Washington would abide by the NATO treaties, mutual defense pact. Now, do you think that this means that that the U.S. is going to continue doing what it's doing with NATO, in which Russia sees NATO as an entity that's encircling it, while at the same time provoking Russia with things like war games?
Yes, I do think that. I think NATO is a relic of the past. It should have been dismantled some time ago. I think Biden's statement that he plans on honoring the agreements with NATO does suggest exactly what you're saying, that Biden plans on continuing to poke the Russian bear, to surround Russia. NATO exists for one purpose and one purpose alone. It was created to counter the Soviet Union. It's been used since the collapse of the Soviet Union to try to counter Russia, and that's what it's going to continue to do, and Biden's making it clear that that's will continue.
Okay, so let's continue the path of NATO, Richard Black, in the form of Ukraine, in terms of having your input here. I'm guessing that Biden is going to want to have some kind of settlement or peace settlement on Ukraine. Of course, that issue is very contentious in terms of how he has said repeatedly that he wants to expand and possibly include, wants NATO to expand and possibly include Ukraine in that picture. How do you think that situation is going to evolve under Biden vis-a-vis Russia and Ukraine?
The main thing that has made it awkward for him is the involvement of his son, Hunter Biden, in some very questionable financial arrangements with Iran. Hunter Biden was just sort of the tip of the iceberg. We have very powerful politicians in Congress whose family members have acquired enormous wealth, and much of that wealth has been by being involved in these never-ending wars, where the United States constantly appropriates money to DOD and CIA and State Department. That money is funneled unaccountably to different companies, and in some cases we see it working its way to people like Hunter Biden. So there's a tremendous vested interest in war. War is our business, and business is thriving. And so it's awkward in Iran, or rather in Ukraine, because We toppled the government in Ukraine some years ago, and we said, well, we're after democracy and so forth, but in fact, we really were looking for conflict and for moving that conflict much closer to the Russian border. But the whole idea of NATO, I certainly agree with your other commentator today. Russia outlived its usefulness and should have been abolished. They should have had a little march and given a medal to everybody in NATO and simply disbanded it at the end of the Cold War. When they didn't, they had to have an enemy. And even though Russia was not an enemy in any respect, it did not have an expansionist philosophy, it didn't have the economic wherewithal to threaten anyone, didn't have the population to do it, and yet it was very necessary to create this boogeyman to justify the tens of thousands of deep staters in NATO and to perpetuate the idea that somehow we had an enemy. We don't have an enemy. Russia is not an enemy. And the only thing that creates hostilities is the fact that we are edging troops right to the very borders of their territorial waters and land, and threatening Russia in a very, very dangerous way, reckless way.
So what about another issue, Daniel Kovalik? Again, one of many that would discuss between these two, and that's the issue of Iran. We know Russia's stance, how it stands on that. I'm not too sure if we understand U.S.'s stance, somewhat murky. But how do you think that Russia would, or how would the U.S. and Russia cooperate with each other when it comes to Iran, even though that is somewhat a moot point because Iran has made its stance very clear when it comes to the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, my hope is that Biden will re-enter that nuclear deal. Iran's made it clear they're willing to do it on day one. I think that will bring back down the temperature between the U.S. and Iran, and frankly bring down the temperature in the Middle East, so I hope that that happens. I think, though, that Israel and Saudi Arabia will be opposed to that, and we'll see if Biden is willing to stand up to those two countries. Trump was not. It's kind of the tail wagging the dog there, and I think it does remain to be seen whether Biden has the fortitude to do that. But I have some cautious optimism that he will, and that he is willing to work with Europe in honoring the nuclear deal, which, you know, Europe is still a party to. So, yes, I have some hope.
You had said, Richard Black, just minutes ago, that you don't really see Russia, if I understood you correctly, to be the threat that it's been perceived to be, something that has been somewhat formed by the way that EU views Russia, perhaps, countries like the UK. And Russia, of course, has been accused of doing some things to make that scenario or to create that scenario. But we're looking at Biden, who once called Putin soulless. I mean, do you think that Biden will approach Russia in an offensive way in terms of dictation? Or will it look it to be somewhat of an ally, which is very hard to actually conceive?
It is almost impossible to make an ally of Russia so long as we have this vast, deep state of NATO operatives in place. All of them, their jobs, their wealth, their position, all depend on having an enemy. And so that is the problem with truly forming an alliance with Russia. In a world without NATO, there is no reason that Russia could not join and become an integral part of Western Europe. Their values are similar. In fact, their new constitution provides that marriage is one man and one woman. It provides for parents' rights over the upbringing of their children. These are things that Americans have struggled to get for generations and couldn't get, and yet they exist in Russia. Russia is totally compatible with Western Europe. They're trying to extend the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to Germany. Germany wants it very badly. Russia wants it very badly. The United States is sanctioning and going contrary to the countries of the European Union on this issue. I see a very natural, very comfortable relationship if we were to drop the militarization. Some people say, well, look, Trump achieved something great because he got the NATO countries to increase their defense spending. For what purpose? Now, I can see some concerns about threats from Turkey, but I do not see any threat from Russia. Russia is no threat whatsoever to Europe, and the whole thing is just a piñata to give us something to strike at.
Okay, well, Daniel Kovalik, we talked about NATO here, we talked about Iran, we talked about Ukraine, but then we take a look at the issue of Navalny. Now, you know, when Russia has come out accusing the U.S. directly of backing demonstrations and protests for Navalny, then obviously that rattles the cage of Putin in a sense, if he does have a cage, and that's, you know, in a sense an interference, if I'm correct to make that assessment. So it doesn't make grounds for what the Kremlin wants, which is a normalization of relations between Moscow and Washington. That's something the Kremlin has come out and said. So is there a limit as to the way these two countries are going to get along when you have the U.S. been accused of it, which, well, it has been accused of this accusation in other countries, which holds true?
Yeah, I mean, look, the U.S. claiming that Russia interfered in the 2016 election, which, by the way, I feel is a dubious claim, is at best the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, the U.S. has interfered, we know, in, 81 different elections throughout the world. This has been documented. And that doesn't even count the times that the U.S. has actually overthrown governments by force and by coups. So, yes, I would not be surprised if the U.S. Was supporting these demonstrations. They're clear from the media that I listen to every day that they support Navalny, even though, frankly, I've seen some statements by him that suggest he's a right-wing racist. But again, that's not surprising. The U.S. backed neo-Nazis in Ukraine, you know. So, but yeah, as long as the U.S. decides it can meddle in other countries like Russia, but then takes umbrage at countries allegedly interfering here, I just think it's not a grounds for a mutual relationship.
There are other hot spots that these two countries need to figure something out on, Richard Black. One of them is Syria. They need to come to some kind of understanding on that. And of course, when we talk about West Asia, or Middle East as it's called, then there also needs to be an understanding there, because Russia does not share all common interests with the U.S. when it comes to this region. How will that be resolved? And we could start by talking about Syria.
You know, the most insightful thing that I saw was put out by Atlantic Council not recently, or rather recently. Atlantic Council is very much a deep state organization, but their analysis was good. And they said that a couple of things. They said Tony Blinken, who is the proposed Secretary of State, has said that public support for U.S. hegemony is diminishing. He suggested that, at least in the short term, Russia and Iran will control the trajectory of events in Syria. Now, he did say that he was going to increase aid to the areas of Idlib province and the Kurdish-occupied northeastern Syria. Now, this means that we will be providing additional enhanced aid to al-Qaeda and to the terrorists that occupy Idlib province. Unfortunately, one of the saddest things is that we have had a consistent policy of starving the Syrian people. Through our sanctions and through devaluing the currency through the SWIFT system, we've created enormous inflation. We have cut off the Syrian people from their major source of wheat that they need for bread. We have stolen their oil, which they need to heat homes in the winter. We've even managed through our extensive sanctions to block the Syrians from receiving medicines to treat cancer and other diseases. Anyone who says that sanctions are designed to simply, twist the arms of wealthy, powerful politicians is a fool.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of sanctions is to crack down on common people, and that's what they do.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. We're going to have to end it there. That was Richard Black, former senator at Virginia State Senate. Thank you for your statements. And also, Daniel Kobalik, thank you, author, lecturer, and lawyer from Pittsburgh. That does it for this edition of The Debate. For Mikko Itali, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye. Until next time.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode from a series of The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio and our discussion concerning the doubts or misconceptions on this very important topic. For this cause, we have invited Islamic researcher Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools to help us answer the questions that we pose in this series of shows. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Sheikh, another question of the day on another misconception or doubt on the topic of Mahdawi or Mahdism is that it is being said that Shias did not have any political power from the, let's say, the time of the Holy Prophet till then, and they wanted to create an opportunity for themselves. That's why they forged this idea of birth of Mahdi, and also they also forged the concept of riba, occultation, in order to make some power at the time that there was nothing for them in leading the society. This baseless doubt and misconception, again, can be looked at in a way that we have seen that at the time of first and second Imam, the Imams were in power, but due to some issues, they were the leaders of the Islamic Ummah, but they were not as the ruler or caliphs of the time. So, Sheikh, how can we look at this doubt and misconception?
Of course, this Wahhabi scholar wants to say that before the year 255 or 260, when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born or Imam Askari alayhi salam was martyred, the Shia did not have any access to power. And then some of the followers and some of the companions of Imam Askari alayhi salam, they said that it's good for us to forge a concept like occultation and claim that our Imam is in occultation, and in future, finally one day he will come back and we will gain the power.
Yeah.
And so forging the concept of occultation was an answer to this political disappointment of the Shia.
True.
Now, as you mentioned, first of all, this is not the case. I mean, when it comes to the Shia, at least at the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam and Imam Hassan alayhi salam, these two imams were in power, so we cannot claim that the Shia and the Shia imams did not have any power before Imam al-Askari alayhi salam and Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. And secondly, I would like to answer this Wahhabi scholar if he agrees with the rulings of those Abbasid and Umayyad caliphs. I mean, somehow, maybe he wants to say that through all these years, the power was in the hands of the Sunni and not the Shia. And my question is that, do you agree and do you confirm all the acts done by the Umayyad caliphs, like from Yazid ibn Muawiyah, who killed Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and the next caliphs and all those cruel and oppressive Abbasid caliphs?
They will say yes.
Not all of them. I mean, when
because they, for example, as the as the case of Yazid, they will say that he was an he was a scholar, he did ijtihad, and he was wrong in his ijtihad.
This is the
worst answer that can ever be said.
The great majority of Sunni scholars, they do not say that.
But even the same doubt cannot be even issued by a Sunni scholar, rather a Wahhabi one. So this also would be the answer from a Wahhabi sheikh, right?
No, my point is that even the Wahhabi scholars and the great majority of the Sunni scholars, let me mention by giving you the example of the hadith of Esnai Ashar Khalifa, there will be 12 caliphs after me.
Right.
We know that
in Bukhari, in the book of Al-Istikhlaf.
Yeah, this narration has been mentioned in various Sunni sources.
يَكُنُوا بَعْدِي أَثْنَا عَشَرَ خَلِيفَةً كُلُّهُمْ مِنْ قُرَيْشِ.
We have different versions, and yes, the gist of the narration is that there will be 12 caliphs after me.
True.
Now, when we study the Sunni books to tell us who are these 12 people, we cannot find any convincing answer. Because of the fact that these Sunni scholars, they say that, okay, we have four caliphs, four Rashidun caliphs, and then Muawiyah, these are five, and Umar ibn Abdul Aziz,
they can
six,
never be reached to 12.
But they do not, they also do not consider people like Yazid, like Marwan ibn Hakam, like Mansur Abbasi, like Safah, like Harun al-Rashid, they do not include them in these 12 caliphs. So this means that at least the great majority of the Sunni scholars, they do not believe in most of the Umayyad caliphs and the Abbasid caliphs as the true successors after the Holy Prophet.
True.
Even we have like Ibn al-Kathir, who is a very anti-Shia scholar. Even, I mean, he is not able to mention 12 people out of all these Umayyad and Abbasid caliphs. One of the Sunni scholars mentions some, I mean, possibilities for this narration, and finally he says that وَلَمْ أَعْلَمْ لِلْحَدِيثَ مَعْنَى. Finally, I was not able to justify this narration, and maybe it is a forged narration, which is not the case.
But
so my point is that we cannot claim that majority of the Sunni scholars approve the acts of the Umayyad and the Abbasid caliphs. So the next point is that what is mentioned by this Wahhabi scholar is the same thing which is mentioned by anti-Islam scholars, by non-Muslim scholars, against the concept of Mahdism.
True.
They say that Muslims have brought about and they have forged the concept of Mahdism because of the fact that they did not have, they are wishing for future. They have political problems, so always they are somehow condoling themselves by saying that in the future we will have a promised Mahdi and he will have the power and the power will be in the hands of the Muslims. My point is that what is mentioned by this Wahhabi scholar is against the concept of Mahdism, which is shared by both Shia and Sunnis. If he is telling the Shia that you forged the concept of Mahdism and occultation because of the fact that you did not have power and you wanted the power in the future, we say that, oh brother, you are negating the whole concept of Mahdism. What you are mentioning is what is mentioned by non-Muslims against the concept of Mahdism. So many people can claim that Mahdism is wrong because Muslims till now they did not have enough power to rule the whole world, and because of that they claim that in future we will have a promised Mahdi. He will come, he will fill the earth with justice, and the only religion over the world will be Islam. All the people will be Muslim, and it is the time that all the Muslims are wishing for. This is the second answer.
Wherever you be, I'll be with you, 'cause you're the one, my heart is too, I need you.
The third answer is that if this analysis of this Wahhabi scholar is true, and I mean, as he mentioned, he claims that the Shia, they forged the concept of Mahdism and occultation because of the political issues, the answer is that the cure and solution for this problem was the concept of Mahdism and not the occultation and the ghiba.
True.
So my point is that the Shia could overcome this political problem by coming of an imam who will fill the earth with justice, and that is Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. They did not need the concept of occultation and ghiba for that. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
The point is that the answer for this political problem is the coming of an imam who will have the power. It could be in future. So Shia did not need the concept of occultation and ghiba for this problem.
But he already negated the concept of the birth of Mahdi. So if there is no Mahdi, so he paved the way. Slowly he comes to this conclusion.
Yeah, this
he first says that there is no Mahdi first. There is no Mahdi. Then, in case they insist on having, for example, occultation or, I don't know, the concept of expecting the Mahdi, it is just because of these, let's say, political deficiencies that they have up to now.
You're right, but my point is that this third answer should be taken into consideration as a separate answer from the previous ones.
Yeah.
So put aside all the other answers,
true,
the fact that the Shia believes in Imam Mahdi and in his birth, let's say that Shia have a political disappointment, a political problem, and they need to have power in future.
True.
The answer, this third answer, regardless of those answers of belief in 12 imams and the narrations,
yeah,
and so on and so forth, this answer is telling us that if it was the reason, the solution for it is coming of an imam to give you the power, not the occultation of an imam and waiting for him for a long, long time. So the answer is telling that if this is the case, what could solve the problem of the Shia was that, for example, in future, a person will be born, like the belief of the Sunnis.
Yeah, yeah.
And he will give us the power. Because this Wahhabi scholar says that this is the philosophy of the concept of occultation and ghiba. My point in this answer is that if this is the case, the solution could be the concept of Mahdism in future.
Yeah.
A person will come in future and he will have the power for the Shia.
Yeah, we can also tell him, okay, no problem. Let's say that Mahdi was not yet born. So a Mahdi will come in future. True?
That's true.
At least we are in common with each other that a Mahdi will come. So this is the element of power for us then.
And that is why, as I mentioned in the second answer, if we accept this point by this Wahhabi scholar, it is against the concept of Mahdism.
Very true.
As believed by all Shia and Sunnis, all Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not only against the concept of Mahdism as viewed by the Shia.
Okay, thank you, Sheikh Murtada, for your enlightenment on the topic and actually the reasoning that you have brought up. Look, brothers and sisters, the question of the day was that concept of intidar, occultation, and talking about two different phases, minor and major occultation of Mahdi, it is being said that it was due to political deficiencies that Shias have in the course of history, and they have created this. So the answer that was provided, one of the answers that I want to mention at the end of the show is that Sheikh Murtada referred to, is that occultation by itself brings no power to us. If there is going to be a Mahdi, the last savior to come, this would be the element of power. And in that case, we and you, the person who makes this doubt and misconception, are in common. So we all believe that a Mahdi will come, regardless of his birth, whether we want to discuss it or not. No, suppose that Mahdi has not yet been born. So this beautiful answer was given by Sheikh Murtada at the end of the session, and hopefully we'll be able to discuss other doubts and misconceptions in the upcoming sessions on The Last Savior from IRRB English Radio. Thanks again for staying tuned. Be blessed. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Allahumma
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjah bin al-Hassan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The UK government is mulling over plans to put some travelers coming to England in so-called quarantine hotels amid concerns about new variants of the virus.
As we vaccinate more people, it becomes more and more important that we protect against any new variants coming in. Once you have that protection, and you don't have new variants in the country, you should protect against them.
Despite the high death toll, case numbers in the UK are slowly falling thanks to the lockdown. But the government is facing mounting pressure over when the restrictions, among them school closures, will be eased. As for the rest of Europe, well, they're worried about an outbreak of the so-called British variant within their borders.
Different European countries have different measures in place, lockdowns, curfews. But with their healthcare systems under immense pressure, they may have to enforce even stricter measures soon.
But the restrictions of freedoms already in place are testing people's patience. In the Netherlands, at least 150 people arrested Monday during unrest and looting in towns and cities across the country over an 8 p.m. curfew.
Het heeft ook niks te maken wat we zagen met strijden voor de vrijheid. We nemen al deze maatregelen.
What we saw has nothing to do with fighting for freedom. We didn't take all these measures for fun. We did so because we are fighting against the virus, and it's the virus which is actually robbing our freedom.
While the UK heads towards its mid-February target of 15 million vaccinations, across the EU, growing frustration with the pace of immunization. Last week, AstraZeneca told the EU it was falling behind on its supply target because of production problems. The EU Commission, in charge of approving and procuring the jabs, isn't happy.
This new schedule is not acceptable to the European Union. The European Union has pre-financed the development of the vaccine and its production and wants to see the return.
The delays will make it harder for the EU to meet its plan to vaccinate 70% of its adult population by late summer, leading to a deepening of the crisis across the bloc. The UK and European Union have survived Brexit and the financial lockdown of 2008, but it remains to be seen if they will survive COVID-19. Saeed Pariza, London.
Iranian Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made a stop in Moscow for talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov on mutual and international issues. In a joint press conference, Zarif said Iran will take proper action whenever the United States lifts the sanctions to pave the way for its return to the 2015 nuclear deal.
What we have heard from the United States administration so far has mostly been in the form of words and announcements of its position. However, it is actions that we respond to.
For his part, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow and Iran share the same position on how to preserve the historic deal, adding that it was up to the United States to take the first steps by removing the sanctions.
Both we and Iran are deeply interested in a full return of signatory states to fulfilling their obligations under the accord.
The top Iranian diplomat said Trump's departure brought along special circumstances that required Tehran and Moscow to coordinate their positions in this regard.
Our focus today was on the Caucasus and the regional efforts for bringing peace and stability in the Caucasus, because I am right now engaged in a regional trip to countries in the Caucasus, plus Russia and Turkey. We also had a major discussion about global situation and how we can revive the nuclear deal.
With the election of Joseph Biden, hopes for a more balanced approach from Washington and a return to the nuclear deal have been revived.
If this happens, and we hope that we'll be able to achieve such a result, then of course the relations between Iran and the Russian Federation will benefit, since they will be removed from illegitimate, illegal unilateral sanctions, both from the United States and from a number of other countries.
Zarif arrived in Moscow after paying a visit to Azerbaijan, where he sat down with Azeri President Ilham Aliyev.
Iran and Russia said they are determined to expand mutual ties and continue cooperation in regional stability and international security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte tendered his resignation, throwing Italy into a government crisis in the midst of a pandemic that has devastated the country. More than 85,000 lives have been lost to coronavirus as Italy's economy is falling deeper into chaos. After surviving two confidence votes last week, Conte has reportedly decided to quit because his executive risked being defeated in a vote over a contested report on the justice system in the Senate, where he no longer has an absolute majority.
President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella received this morning the President of the Council of Ministers Giuseppe Conte, who handed in the resignation of the government that he presides. The President of the Republic has decided to invite the government to remain in charge to handle the current affairs.
The government was plunged into crisis after former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi pulled his junior partner Italia Viva out of the ruling coalition on January 13. Renzi had withdrawn his support over issues including differences on the COVID-19 recovery plan and the handling of the coronavirus outbreak. Conte is now expected to seek a third mandate from the President of the Republic, Sergio Mattarella, to form a new executive with a broader coalition. Should he fail to do so, Mattarella may decide to bring in a new prime minister or call for snap elections.
La risposta è molto semplice.
I'm going to make this very simple. This political crisis will result in more interest to be paid by Rome on its public debt due to an increase of the spread between Italy and Germany's 10-year yields. Whoever becomes prime minister next will have to implement tough reforms, including slashing health and social spending, in order to access the resources allocated in the EU's recovery fund.
On Wednesday, Italy's head of state, Mattarella, is slated to start a round of formal consultations with party leaders and other institutional figures to see whether a new coalition can be formed.
It is uncertain where this political crisis will lead. What is certain is that not even the world's worst pandemic in a century has persuaded the Italian politicians to remain united to face an unprecedented health crisis together. After the collapse of 66 governments in just 75 years of democracy, the country's future is now in the hands of President Mattarella. Max Civili, Rome.
Streets were deserted, shops were closed, and businesses were abandoned in Indian-controlled Kashmir as India celebrated its 72nd Republic Day.
What is there for the people of Kashmir to celebrate? Our special status was stripped, and so were our rights. The promises that were made were just a show-off. Our jobs, our land, and our opportunities are on sale. So what should I celebrate?
Amid suspended internet services and heightened security arrangements, authorities have held a symbolic Republic Day parade in a highly secured sports stadium in the heart of Srinagar. Indian-controlled Kashmir came under India's absolute control after New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in August 2019. Following the move, pro-freedom groups in the disputed region were detained so that any dissent against India's decision would be prevented.
The democratic values for which the India is advocating and India is calling in the world that it is the biggest democracy, they are not following it actually on ground. Democracy gives the right of dissent.
Although New Delhi says the revocation of Article 370 was to integrate Jammu and Kashmir into the rest of India for easier development and equal opportunity for the citizens, analysts say the reality on the ground is quite the opposite.
After revocation of Article 370, which was one of the articles of the Constitution of India, the government's attitude has been more aggressive and arrogant, not people-friendly. There is no democracy on ground. The democratic setup has been closed down and an authoritative setup has been put in, which is working with a dictatorial attitude. And the people are suffering.
By staying indoors on India's Republic Day, people of Kashmir have once again displayed their level of alienation. Analysts say India needs to take necessary steps and fulfill its promises in order to win their hearts. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The cities are the most important human habitat in the modern era. They show the extent of civilization, social life, and the blossoming of the capabilities of the citizens. Today, that geographical boundaries do not exist thanks to the modern communication technologies, better urban management techniques can be identified through sharing global experiences. The municipality of Tehran has been a pioneer in hosting international events since 2014 and has brought together academic and executive elites in the field of urban management from all over the world to provide a forum for exchanging urban experiences. The fifth edition of the Tehran Golden Adobe Global Award was held at a time that the whole world is hit by the spread of the coronavirus.
Amid the corona pandemic, we were in touch with the mayors of many major cities of the world to share experiences, We informed them about the tough situation of Iran, where it is hit by the cruel sanctions on the one hand and the corona problems on the other hand. We used urban symbols like Azadi Square to sympathize with those struggling with the pandemic. Via video mapping, we were the first city to sympathize with those hit by the virus in China's Wuhan.
Some distinguished foreign guests who were present at the closing ceremony of Tehran Golden Adobe Award also touched upon the role of urban management at critical times.
We have to think that COVID has imposed new expectations but also new realities, and we have to look at capacities for a new digital age. And finally, it's not only about capacities, it's also about the agency, the institutions. So we have to look at how government and institutions operate in this context and how we can look at more healthier, greener and equitable policies.
At the end of the ceremony, Tehran's Global Award for Urban Management in different categories was handed to the best project in the cities, regions and local communities worldwide. Tehran Golden Adobe Award is a comprehensive academic non-profit initiative that specializes in international urban management research and exchange. However, due to the spread of the coronavirus, this edition focused on methods used by urban managers to cope with the pandemic. Human Abadi, Tehran.
Yet another effort to stop Saudi Arabia's devastating war in Yemen. This time, 24 British Parliament members have urged Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab to halt the country's arms sales to Riyadh. In a letter, they have underlined that up to £15 billion worth of UK-made arms have been sold to the Saudi regime since it launched a war on Yemen in 2015. The letter also cites a recent UN report on the situation in Yemen, adding that the war has already claimed 233,000 lives, while about 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. Many political experts believe that the Saudi-led war is being perceived globally as unwarranted and genocidal.
The global perception now about the Yemen war, if nothing else, is that this was unwarranted and genocidal. I mean, there's no justification for it. And it was a Saudi assault, but orchestrated by UK and US military personnel. Officers were in the Saudi capital from the very beginning. And of course, all the weaponry that the Saudi military uses in this genocidal assault is U.S. and U.K. military hardware.
Since 2015, the Saudi-led bombing and blockade of Yemen have devastated much of the poor country's infrastructure, with the UN calling it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Half of Yemen's population is now on the brink of famine, many of them children. The country has also experienced the world's worst cholera outbreak and now struggling with an alarming COVID-related death rate. From the onset of war, many international rights groups and activists have slammed the West in general and the United States, Britain, France and Canada in particular for their support for the Saudi-led coalition. They have repeatedly called on these governments to suspend weapon sales to Riyadh and Abu Dhabi to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. In September, a UN experts group named Canada for the first time as the one perpetuating the conflict in Yemen by selling arms to Saudi Arabia. So far, international calls have fallen on deaf ears as not only Saudi Arabia continues with its bombing campaign and blockade of Yemen, but its Western backers too continue supplying the regime with lethal weapons. It seems that what matters to Western powers most is putting their profit out of arms exports to their repressive Arab regimes above human rights and the lives of millions of impoverished Yemenis.
The Democrat-led lower house of Congress has forced a second impeachment trial in the Senate for ex-President Donald Trump on charges of incitement of insurrection following the deadly protests inside Capitol Hill on January 6th. There is seemingly no chance that a supermajority two-thirds of the Senate, which is evenly split between both parties, will vote to convict Trump this time either. Recent polls show America is almost evenly split on if Trump deserves a conviction, meaning the trial will be yet another highly divisive political event.
I think Democrats are basically taking this opportunity to once and for all kind of like rally around that, like, this person is, like, you know, evil, he's bad for the system, this is a terrible president to send. They're really just trying to hammer down that you can't get away with this stuff. This, and the president in his own words really did like rile up these people to come to the Capitol and, you know, wreak havoc. It's more of, I think, what they're going towards is like, you can't come here and touch us.
Analysts suggest that Democrats may be pushing the trial as a way to weaken the Republican Party by forcing Republicans to openly choose between pro-Trump and anti-Trump factions. Conservatives could be weakened by infighting for years. Trump remains incredibly popular among Republicans, but a conviction would forbid him from holding office and running for president in 2024. Given the record anger, disunity, and polarization, many wonder if a successful conviction could backfire and provoke even greater problems.
All it really does is creates a vacuum for another figurehead to kind of go in there and take control of this mob of quite literally fascist. This is like fascism in actual definition. And what this does is, you know, we know Trump is a con man. We know Trump was often like bumbling his way through things. He was kind of like, you know, a joke, a mockery of the system. This unfortunately creates a vacuum where someone more competent in terms of just, you know, oppression, repression, can take control of this vacuum that Trump is leaving behind.
New President Joe Biden is being criticized for allowing Congress to focus on a trial instead of creating legislation to cope with a raging pandemic and a once-in-a-century economic disaster. Many fear the controversial trial will eliminate willingness for bipartisanship in a Congress in which Democrats have only a very slim margin of control. That's a different agenda than Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first 100 days in 1933, when he rolled out 15 major pieces of legislation, which began the so-called New Deal and economic recovery. The trial will begin on February 8th and must dominate the proceedings of Congress until its conclusion weeks later. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
They are clearly very different issues, but EU foreign affairs ministers have agreed the two main policy areas on which they want to make progress with the United States are climate change and the Iran nuclear deal, officially known as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The ministers have just concluded face-to-face talks on the subjects in Brussels.
From climate change to Iran and JCPOA, and the most important ones, the most urgent ones, and the ministers are ready for a new start.
That new start is necessary because of Donald Trump's hate-fueled anti-Iran campaign during the past 4 years. The former U.S. president pulled Washington out of the nuclear deal in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions designed to try and cripple Iran's economy. Firms across the European Union have made it clear they very much want to do business with the Islamic Republic. Economists say U.S. banking-related sanctions against Tehran are stifling that business. There is now some optimism that change is coming because Joe Biden has indicated the U.S. will rejoin the nuclear accord, which was signed by Iran and six world powers in 2015 and underpinned by the United Nations. With the possibility that U.S. sanctions against Tehran will be lifted, EU businesses should prepare to start trading, experts suggest.
I think it probably makes sense to move now and to be one of the early players in the right framework, of course.
With a population greater than 80 million people, Iran represents a big opportunity for EU firms, it has been pointed out. The 27-country bloc, which is heavily dependent on energy imports, could also address fuel security issues.
Iran would have its energy fields, its gas and oil, which are huge, some of the biggest in the world, opened again to markets, in particular the European market, which would be, you know, a beneficiary of this.
Tehran says Washington can only rejoin the JCPOA if there are no preconditions. Since entering the White House last week, Joe Biden has already spoken with Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron about the nuclear deal. The big unknown right now is, will Biden be willing or able to stand up to those who want to see the agreement completely disintegrate? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkey
Turkey and Greece held their first direct talk in 5 years over tensions which grew between the two neighboring countries over the past years. Turkey has been at loggerheads with Greece and Cyprus.